Coming up is the news.
New revelations out, the U.S. military killed scores of women and children in a 2019 air raid in Syria and then covered it up. The Daesh terror group says it's been behind a deadly attack on a police headquarters in Pakistan. And also in the headlines, hackers targeting FBI email server, sending out thousands of spam emails, warning of a cyber attack. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Bashar Zajafi. Good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, the United States military has reportedly tried to cover up air raids that claimed the lives of scores of civilians in Syria 3 years ago. According to the New York Times, the military officials went so far as to bulldoze the attack site and remove any mention of the strike in a subsequent probe.
It's March 18th, 2019. An American F-15 drops a 500-pound bomb on a crowd of women and children in an area near the town of Baghouz in Syria's Deir ez-Zor province. Minutes later, another warplane drops an even bigger bomb, then another, killing the few survivors of the first strike. The initial death toll was put at 70. Fast forward to November 2021. The U.S. Central Command has acknowledged that 80 people were killed in the strikes. While claiming that 16 of the victims were Daesh terrorists, it admits that it's unclear if the rest were civilians. CENTCOM has also defended the attacks as justified and conducted in self-defense, arguing that the targeted women and children could have been combatants. But investigations carried out by the New York Times provide a different account of the incident. According to the Times, a U.S. Air Force lawyer who oversaw the operation believed he had witnessed possible war crimes and notified the authorities. The Pentagon later carried out an independent inquiry into the incident, but the Times says the subsequent report was, quote, stripped of any mention of the bombing. The newspaper also says the reports were delayed and classified, and the attack site was bulldozed shortly after.
So this is one piece that is coming out, very important, because it shows just how criminal the war is and the cover-up that takes place at every level, even when within the army, those who saw it and have access tried to bring it to light and instead were dismissed.
The report bore a striking resemblance to a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital Kabul in late August this year that claimed the lives of 10 members of the same family, including 7 children. The U.S. military initially said it had targeted a Daesh terrorist planning a suicide attack in the wake of the bombing at the Kabul airport that had killed 13 U.S. troops and dozens of Afghan civilians 3 days before. The Pentagon similarly defended the Butch strike as a, quote, righteous one.
Daniel Hale, the former U.S. Air Force intelligence analyst who worked with the NSA, who worked with JSOC, is now going to be spending the next 45 months in prison for having let the world know that 90% of the victims of U.S. airstrikes are innocent bystanders, basically civilians.
To put things into perspective, the United States conducted about 1,000 airstrikes in Syria and Iraq in 2019 alone, using over 4,700 bombs and missiles. The official civilian toll for the entire year is 22.
Now to discuss that a little bit, let's bring in Elijah Magner, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Good to have you with us, Elijah. As you see, this is a botch to cover up. The U.S. Has been blaming others and even embarking on regime change for doing what it is doing itself elsewhere in different parts of the world. And now we have this one out of Syria. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Thank you for having me. Actually, it's not at all surprising what we heard about this U.S. attack, because the Americans have done this attack in the past, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and many times in Syria. This is not the first time at all. And disregarding the safety of the civilians and avoiding targeting the civilians is not the American forces' best cup of tea. So they have ground to guide the airplane and to select the target. And when the forces on the ground are careless about the civilian casualty, it's because there is no accountability and no respect whatsoever to the international law. And this is accounted as a war crime. And I think this needs a very serious investigation by the court to check all the war crimes that are committed by the U.S. throughout the decade. And it's not only one simple attack of a civilian in Syria. We've seen also an attack on the Thalda mountain several years ago by the Americans, and also they said it was a mistake and they just brush it and everything moved on. This is not acceptable and someone should stop that. And I think this is also the work of the United Nations to stop this crime action. But unfortunately, the United Nations is also directed by the Americans, who refuse any sentence or any to be submitted to the international war crime.
Okay, thanks for that, Elijah Magner, journalist and political analyst in Brussels. An Afghan family that has lost 10 members, including 7 children, in a U.S. drone strike in Kabul says it is still seeking justice and has yet to hear from the U.S. officials more than 2 months after the tragic event. Our correspondent has more from Kabul.
These are the graves of 10 innocent family members who were killed by a U.S. drone strike on a home in Kabul. After the attack, the Pentagon apologized for the mistake and said the U.S. is considering making payments to the family of the victims and will get them out of Afghanistan. But it seems Washington has been indifferent to these promises as the family still awaits justice.
The attack was very horrific to our family. It martyred 10 of our loved ones and shocked those who have survived. When our relatives come here, it hurts them as they remember those innocent children martyred here. Of course, the U.S. should be held accountable.
Justice should be done to us. They promised that those responsible would be tried in a court, compensation would be paid, and they would take us out of Afghanistan. After their announcement, they have done nothing. They must stay true to their commitments.
Afghans and U.S. war survivors have repeatedly asked for meaningful transparency and accountability for the U.S. killings of their loved ones, but they have not received it from Washington so far.
The U.S. has always lied to these people. They make promises but don't fulfill them. For instance, see Ajmal's family that were decimated by the U.S. All of those killed were innocent. It has been 3 months that their relatives are left helpless.
People also believe that during its invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. military has always killed civilians, lied about it, and finally exonerated themselves. More than 2 months after this tragic attack, the U.S. has not taken any practical steps to reach out to the victims' family or pay compensation to them. And the survivors are still awaiting justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Now, just a day after a bombing attack that ripped through a police barracks in northern Pakistan, Daesh terrorists now saying it was their job. Police are confirming 2 officers died in the blast. 6 civilians, including a young girl, were also injured. It took place in Bajar, that's a district near the border with Afghanistan. Daesh terrorists have claimed a string of bloody violence, including attacks on mosques in Afghanistan in the past months. But such attacks have been rare in Pakistan. The Soviet coalition's warplanes have targeted Yemen's western province of Hodeida, killing at least 4 civilians, including 3 children. The attack was staged after Yemen's armed forces took control of vast areas in that province. Our correspondent has more.
In a fresh airstrike carried out by Saudi warplanes against Yemenis, 4 civilians, including 3 children, were killed. 2 others were also wounded in the strike in Tohata district in the Hodeida province. Officials say the attack is a clear violation of the Stockholm Agreement that prohibited airstrikes on the coastal province.
There are many violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition, whether through airstrikes or direct attacks on civilians by the mercenaries in Tohaita and other areas. The Stockholm Agreement prohibited any military action in the Hodeida Governorate, but unfortunately, the violations of this unbrokered agreement did not stop.
Observers say the international community's inaction towards the continuous Saudi attacks on Yemeni civilians, especially the silence of the UN Security Council, is yet another proof of how Riyadh is bribing its way through the world body.
Through our long experience with the United Nations, it's clear that Saudi and Emirati money plays the most prominent role in determining the decisions of the world body, including the Security Council, the Secretary General, and the UN envoy. There is a clear bias regarding the Saudi-led coalition.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces took control of several districts in the coastal province of Hodeidah, including the international road linking Sana'a with Hodeidah, after a sudden withdrawal of the Emirati-backed forces.
Regardless of the catastrophic situation in Yemen, which the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, the international community keeps turning a blind eye to the Saudi violations against millions of Yemenis. People here believe the inaction emboldens Saudi Arabia to continue its crimes in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The hackers back in action again, their target this time, the email system of the FBI. A huge number of spam emails have been sent out warning a cyber attack is taking place. The FBI says it's investigating the attack and that a compromised server is out of service. The hacking has sparked a flood of calls from worried organizations seeking advice from the FBI. A cyber threat tracking company says at least 100,000 emails were sent out from the FBI account. U.S. government agencies have been hacked several times recently. One of the most high-profile among them was the SolarWinds attack last year. It gave hackers access to classified data of several government agencies. Just as the Chinese and U.S. presidents are getting prepared for a virtual meeting, officials from the two sides do not seem to be backing away from their stances on Taiwan. Top diplomats from the U.S. and China have traded warnings over the phone. Antony Blinken says that Beijing needs to stop military, diplomatic, and economic pressure against Taiwan and engage in, quote, meaningful dialogue to resolve issues peacefully. But Wang Yi wants Washington to change its dangerous actions that seem supportive of Taiwan's independence and harm peace across the strait. Washington has angered Beijing with its military support and diplomatic contacts with Taipei, most recently a visit by a group of lawmakers to the island. President Joe Biden and Xi Jinping will meet online for a discussion of their differences Monday. Well, let's move on with the rest of this edition. Europe facing a growing migrant crisis. The situation is now spiraling out of control at the Poland-Belarus border, where thousands of migrants remain stranded for many days amid a bitter political standoff. Migrants, mostly from the Middle East and Asia, are amassed at the EU's external border in Belarus. Poland and Lithuania are refusing to let them cross. At least 8 have died, and fears are growing for the safety of others. The Polish government estimates that around 1,500 people are camped there. It's accusing Russia, an ally of Belarus, of orchestrating the crisis. The European Union is also blaming Belarus, saying it's pushing the migrants toward the border in retaliation for sanctions. Now, Belarus saying it will cut off gas supplies to Europe in case new sanctions are imposed. Russian president has also pointed a finger at Western states. Vladimir Putin says political, military, and economic motives are in play. Conflict and poverty in parts of the world force many people to flee their home countries in pursuit of a better life. Over the past years, asylum seekers and migrants have been seen embarking on hazardous journeys, but often let down by countries and governments calling themselves human rights defenders. We have a report.
Pervasive challenges remain for migrants and asylum seekers no matter Europe, the United States, or Asia. The recent immigrant crisis on the Belarusian border with Poland has refreshed the plight refugees have endured at the hands of some governments. Thousands of asylum seekers are currently stranded in desperate conditions on the Belarusian border, with thousands of Polish soldiers, guards, and police on the other side blocking their entry. Ironically, the European Union has backed Poland's move in line with the bloc's resolve that it will go to any length to prevent migrants from reaching its external borders. This means turning a blind eye to even gross human rights abuses against refugees. Instead of searching for a mechanism to resolve the crisis, the EU has rather opened a diplomatic war with Belarus and Russia by directly pointing its finger at the two for the current problem. The 27-member bloc is not an exception. Just recently, the United States violently encountered with mostly Haitian immigrants near its borders.
Hundreds were deported and thousands were sent to detention centers. It seems the Biden administration has continued the footsteps of its predecessor that took a tough stance on asylum seekers. An estimated 70,000 people destined for the U.S. have encountered with similar fates over the past 4 years. The brutal family separation was the darkest part of the Trump era, as authorities are still unable to track down parents of hundreds of kids. The treatment of immigrants by the U.S. highlights its double standards on human rights. The issue Washington often uses as a pretext to impose sanctions on others. But the real question is, what is the root cause of the migrant crisis? Isn't the West, especially the United States, the main culprit for its wars and the subsequent influx of refugees in countries such as Syria, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Afghanistan? Afghanistan is a live example that was left in a mess by the U.S. and its allies after almost 2 decades of military presence. People had no choice but to flee the country after the Taliban takeover in mid-August. The number of immigrants has even increased in neighboring Iran, with over 5,000 Afghans reportedly entering the country on a daily basis. The UN has praised Iran, but the sanctions-hit country hasn't received some $136 million in funding the world body said the Islamic Republic needed to support the refugees.
In Bulgaria, people are heading for the polls in the third general elections this year with the hope of bringing an end to the political stalemate that's been gripping the nation for some time. Voters are choosing a new president and parliament. The incumbent, Roman Radev, is tipped to win a second term. Surveys indicating that his key challenger is Anastas Gergigov, who is backed by former Prime Minister Boyko Borisov. Analysts are predicting a low turnout because of COVID concerns and the general voter apathy after the inconclusive elections in April and July. Now, those votes produce fragmented parliaments where parties fail to cobble together a coalition. The Balkan country is facing an economic slowdown plus a health crisis, being the least vaccinated nation in the EU. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
Tell a little about yourself.
I'm Eric Shimanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, November 14th, 2021. I'm Atefer Fani, hosting this program today. As you may know, Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. If you have any messages for our listeners around the world, then you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Please do remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please don't go away and keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, your program. And congratulations, everyone, on the auspicious birth anniversary of Imam Hassan Askari, the 11th era of Prophet Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny. So peace, joy, and love to you all on this auspicious day. Welcome back. Warm greetings to you. And as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports, as you may know, are very helpful and useful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers, because these reception reports enable us to provide a better service, a high quality service to our listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an EQSL card from us. So here, I do express my appreciations to those of our listeners who have sent us reception reports, including Bubul Gupta from India, Harald Seuss from Austria, and Abdul Razak from Bangladesh. So Bubul Gupta, Harald Seuss, and Abdul Razak, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. Many thanks for sending us these reception reports. And I do express my warm gratitude to those of our great listeners who have sent us emails and letters from around the world, including an email from Lu Dacheng from China, Di Bas Kamal Hazarika from India, who has sent us an email. Sahodat Hussein from Bangladesh has sent us an email. Dziugas Grebliūnas from Lithuania has sent us an email. And the last but not the least is an email from Hermod Pedersen from Sweden. So, after a short break, I will be back with these kind emails and letters from around the world. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, the Sunday program, of course, your program, dear listeners. As I said, we have received an email from China. This email is from Lu Dacheng. Lu Dacheng from China says, "Dear IRIB English Radio staff, hello. I'm very happy to know that you reply my email. I'm very glad to receive the EQSL card of IRIB English Radio based in Tehran. I also got very happy by hearing your athletes receive medals in international tournaments. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, Lu Dacheng from China, and thank you very much for sending us this email. Of course, we reply to the emails of all our dear listeners around the world, and of course, as soon as possible, we will send you an EQSL card. Thank you for writing to your radio, IRIB, English radio based in Tehran. And that's great. It seems that you love sports and you know about the medals received by Iranian athletes in international tournaments, including Olympics and the recent wrestling events. Of course, that was held recently in different arenas of the world, and that's great that you know about it. Luda Cheng from China, write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English radio programs. Many thanks for writing this great email, Luda Cheng from China. And from Bangladesh, we have an email from Sahodat Hussein from Bangladesh. Sahodat Hussein from Bangladesh says, "Dear IRIB English radio staff, my warm regards and cordial love to you all from Bangladesh. We think IRIB is a strong media in the world. Your website also is very informative and attractive. We get all the information about Iran and the world by your radio, and the programs are very helpful to increase our knowledge. We love your radio programs because they give us more knowledge. Thank you very much for your nice programs. Sincerely yours." Salam and warmest greetings to you. So that's Hussein from Bangladesh, and we do express our appreciations to you for sending us this really encouraging message to your radio, IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much. It seems that you love our radio because, as you described it, as informative, attractive, strong media. As you said, this is a strong media in the world. Thank you very much for that. Of course, IRIB English Radio, and of course, generally, IRIB, the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, is the only reliable source of giving information and getting information about Islamic Republic of Iran. As you said, you get all the information about Iran, the authentic information, and of course about the world by IRIB and IRIB English Radio. Many thanks for giving us your views about the broadcast of our radio, IRIB English Radio, and giving us positive energy and positive vibes about our radio. Thank you very much for your really encouraging and inspiring message and email. So that's Hussein from Bangladesh. Write to us soon and tell us your views about the IRIB English radio programs. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. Thank you again. So, dear listeners, after a short break and a music, I will be back with an email from India. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. You just heard a beautiful piece of music from, actually, this is a traditional music from north of Iran. As I said, we have an email from India. This email is from Dibakmal Hazarika, and let's see what he says. "I have listened to your today's edition of Listeners Special Program. I like listening to this program very much. In today's program, you have read listeners' letters, emails, and reception reports coming from around the world. I very much enjoyed today's program, and I found it so informative and entertaining. Salam and warm greetings to you, Hazarika from India, and many thanks for writing this email to your radio, IRIB English Radio. We are so happy that you enjoyed listeners' special, as you said. You listened to, as you said at the time you were writing this letter, to today's edition of Listeners' Special Program. So you liked this program very much and you enjoyed it, yes. We read the letters, the emails from around the world, then the reception reports coming from around the world. So you enjoyed it very much. Thank you very much for letting us know about your feelings about IRB English radio program, especially listeners special. Many thanks for writing this email to us. Hazarika from India, write to us soon and tell us your views about other program or programs of IRB English radio. From Lithuania, as I said, we have an email from Desiogas Grepliunas, one of our regular listeners. So, Desiogas Grepliunas, it's a very hard name, says, hello and sorry for sending you an email after a long time. I'm interested in different countries and their cultures, and shortwave radio is one of the instruments to do that. I do also want to visit Iran once the pandemic is over. It seems to be an amazing jewel of Asia. To be honest, I still haven't received the QSL card. Could you send it again? Kind regards and stay safe as well. Salam and warm greetings to you. That's your guest, Greb Leonas from Lithuania. And many thanks for sending us this email from your region, from your country in Europe. Lithuania. So you've been sending this email after a long time. So you're listening to IRB English Radio and you like the different, as you said, you like the different culture of different countries, and it seems that you're getting familiarized with the culture of Iran through shortwave radio of IRB English Radio. And thank you very much for this compliment. As you said, Iran is the jewel of Asia, and that's great. We hope that someday in the future you visit Iran. We invite you to Iran. And my colleagues will soon send you an eQSL card, because sending paper QSL cards is not possible at the time of pandemic. And all our great listeners will soon receive an eQSL card from IRIB English Radio very soon. Thank you very much for sending us this email, Desiogas Grepliunas from Lithuania. Write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs. And after a short break, I will be back with an email from Hermod Pedersen from Sweden. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and from Sweden, we have an email from Hermod Pedersen, one of our regular listeners. Hermod says, dear radio friends, having realized the vast sources of radio transmitters in Iran on medium wave, I am now studying and learning a lot more about the Islamic Republic of Iran, its geography and history. All thanks to your medium wave stations. However, it seems impossible to get in contact with any of these stations. That is why I am sending this to you as the IRIB English service. I'm writing as a long-time radio listener, a DXer, hoping to receive a brief note as a verification or QSL of my reception from your site. That would be a nice memory for me. Having retired as a newspaper reporter, after some 40 years in the media business, I'm happy to find some time for DXing again. For me, this hobby started way back in 1971. Today, in this era of more and more streaming media, I believe that traditional audio is still a great source of both information and entertainment from various parts of the world. Hello, salam, and warm greetings to you, Hermod Pedersen from Sweden, and thank you very much for sending us this email from your country, from your region, Sweden. It seems that you are, and you have been, a colleague of ours, because You were a reporter, and that's great. Thank you very much for sending us this email. So you have been listening to IRB English Radio for a very long time, and you have been get familiarized with the geography, history, and culture of Iran through these medium wave radio stations. And of course, my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card because you are one of our radio listeners. Yes, they will soon send you an EQSL card because sending paper QSL cards is not possible in the time of pandemic. So write to us soon and tell us your views about the programs of IRB English Radio. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. Hermod Pedersen from Sweden. Thank you again. Write to us soon, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon, Hermod Pedersen from Sweden. And dear listeners of IRB English Radio and listeners special, time tells me that we have to skip to the next section of today's program, which is, of course, today's interview, which is conducted with one of our regular listeners. Let's take a listen.
My name's Christopher Lewis. I've been a listener to the IRIB English Radio for nearly 16, 17 years, probably a little bit longer now. I'm just interested in shortwave broadcasts in general, Iran in particular, and events in and around the Middle East. I've just had a general interest in shortwave for a long, long time, and very interested in cultures as well. Well, first and foremost, with IRIB, I like listening to the news. That's one feature I've always looked forward to listening to, and also news commentaries, because it's not just international news, it's regional and local news that I'm interested in, and IRIB for me delivers that. It's concise, the news is put together very, very well, it's gathered very well, it's accurate, and also other programs afterwards, news analysis, commentary about events in general, world events, and Iran's view on what's happening in the world, not only close to home, but also around the globe itself. I also enjoy listeners' programs and to find out what other listeners think of IRIB and what other stations they listen to, what their view is on Iran and Iran's views about the world. Yes, I would just encourage everybody to carry on tuning in to IRIB, sending your reception reports, which I know are very useful to the station itself, and just carry on sending letters of support and interest and learning more about Iran and such a wonderful country it is, because it's got a lot of culture to offer, and one day it's on my bucket list to visit. I'd love to come and visit Iran.
Before we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special, again, I congratulate everyone on the auspicious birth anniversary of Imam Hassan Askari, the 11th era of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. And I thank all our great listeners who have sent us reception reports and also emails and letters from around the world, including Lu Da Cheng from China, Deba Kamal Hazarika from India, Sahadat Hussein from Bangladesh, Desikas Greb Lunas from Lithuania, Hermod Pedersen from Sweden, Bobo Gupta from India, Harald Sus from Austria, and Abdur Raza from Bangladesh. Many thanks for being with us, and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us.
We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pastoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pastodayenglish. Thank you all for being with RIB English Radio.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instrument.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. For more than 6.5 years have passed since Saudi Arabia initiated its onslaught on the Yemeni people, a violent bombing campaign of the infrastructure as well as civilian areas caused an extensive amount of damage, and more importantly, it caused the loss of so many lives. However, the tide has changed as the Yemeni army currently has the upper hand and is now on the verge of taking over the oil-rich city of Ma'arib. Is defeat near for the Saudis and all of their allies from the Persian Gulf to the west? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on The Spotlight. I'm going to start this discussion off crossing over to Sana'a, talking to Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Abdul Latif, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on the latest situation on the ground there.
Thank you so much. Actually, the Yemeni army managed to liberate the Al-Falaj area. The Saudi Arabian coalitions have a military point in that area, and so many travelers have been or have got kidnapped in that military point. It is the eastern gate to Ma'arib. The Yemeni army managed to liberate this area, and this is an important point for the Yemeni army, and important advantage for the Yemeni army to keep encircling the city and liberate the city from the Saudi backers and also from the terrorist group. Actually, the leader of the Al-Qaeda in the Syrian Peninsula, Khalid al-Atrashi, admitted that they have been fighting alongside the Saudi coalition forces in 11 military fronts, including Ma'arib. He said that their participation is insistent, and no one can deny that. And this admission refutes the allegations of the Saudi-backed forces and the Saudi-backed coalition that they are not using terrorists to fight the Yemeni army. Yemen's armed forces have been saying that for 7 years, that they are not fighting only the invaders, but also the terrorist groups, whether in Ma'arib or in Al-Zayba or Sa'id or Hudaybah or the front across the country. In Al-Fadayda, the Morati-backed forces have suddenly withdrawn their food from so many areas, and I believe that they will be seeing there with a goal to lift the city for the enemy army to control the city. Military experts say that this was a goal from in the approach of gathering the officers to protect the bad elements of the state and also to protect the south of Yemen, as the Yemeni army is liberating Marib just a matter of time, and they want to lift Marib and think about what will be after the falling of Marib in the hands of the Yemeni army.
All right, thanks so much. That was our update out of Sana'a from our correspondent on the ground there, Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Now I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight, historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hausa, and journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Hausa with Brett. As time goes on, why does it appear to be more difficult for the Saudis to inflict defeat on the Yemeni army?
I think the main reason for this is that the Saudis have gone to war with much the same strategy as their overlord, so to say, the Americans and the Israelis have always been doing. That is the shock and awe strategy, the idea that by overwhelming them with military hardware, with military prowess and power, by a massive display of what you can field in battle, that will overwhelm the enemy in such to such an extent that they will completely collapse, that their morale will collapse, and you can basically take over the country in a matter of weeks. That's the idea, the strategy, the doctrine that is behind a lot of the invasions that the United States has waged in the past 20 years. It is the strategy behind what the Israelis are doing in Palestine for decades now. And it's the same doctrine that the Saudis have been trying to use. Unfortunately for them, the shock and awe doctrine is completely and utterly useless against a nation that is united in a common cause, because you cannot defeat a country with military hardware alone, especially if that military hardware, like the Saudis and the Americans and the Zionists, when that military hardware is specifically aimed at air superiority, and that is what we have seen for so long already. One of the first things that the Saudis did when they attacked Yemen is almost completely destroy the Yemeni Air Force, and that's why up until this point the Yemeni Air Force is nearly non-existent indeed. The Yemeni Air Force as a unit still exists, but the majority field drones and other unmanned aerial vehicles. They don't have any airplanes. So Saudi Arabia still maintains air superiority, just like the Americans have done when they invaded Afghanistan, when they invaded Iraq, and still like what the Zionists have over Palestine right now. But the problem is, you cannot defeat a country like that. You cannot win a war just by bombing alone. You can win battles, you can advance rapidly, but you cannot maintain. And that is exactly what has been happening here. The Saudis have been overwhelming the Yemenis in the beginning of this war, have been advancing many, many hundreds of kilometers into Yemeni land, but they have not been able to really capture large territory of, like, large population centers, especially in the north and in the west, where the population of Yemen is majority local.
So was it, let me just jump in here, was it a total miscalculation? Let me throw this, let me cross over to London and say it, Mohsen. How do you see it? Was there a total miscalculation going into this to begin with by the Saudis, by the Emiratis, by their those who support them like the Americans and the Brits?
I think there was a huge miscalculation. I mean, they called it the Operation Decisive Storm precisely because they thought that it would be all done and dusted within 3 or 4 weeks. That's exactly what bin Salman, who initiated this war, thought, what he intended. That's come as a complete shock to them that it hasn't worked out that way. The American intelligence has obviously failed on this. The Zionist intelligence has failed on this in terms of giving the Saudis insufficient reports on what the Yemeni morale was, what the Ansarullah's morale was, what their capabilities were. Those capabilities, of course, have grown rapidly during the war since 2015. But at that time, clearly they got some very, very bad intelligence. And what actually has transpired is that the Saudis have now spent in excess of $300 billion on a war against almost the poorest, if not the poorest, nation on the Arab Peninsula. And in return, they've really failed in every target that they had. In fact, the reverse has happened. The Yemeni Ansarullah forces have not only held them up till 2018, but actually in 2018 turned the tables on them and actually went for the jugular, went on the offensive. And that offensive is absolutely mind-boggling because the equipment of the Yemenis, the tactics of the Yemenis, the strategies of fighting, etc., have been absolutely amazing and a real kind of eye-opener for any military.
What do you think has been key in that, said Mohsen? You talked about the offensive and how they have turned the tables. I mean, what has been key in that, being able to turn the tables, even though you just pointed out rightfully it's totally inequitable if we compare the type of equipment that both sides have?
Well, number one, the Yemenis have a huge faith. This is really not to be underestimated. Their spiritual and religious commitment to anti-oppression, towards against tyranny, against the Saudis' tyranny, of course, but also the Zionist tyranny, was totally, I think, underestimated by their enemies. The tactics that they've employed have been unique insofar as they haven't gone out and fought like a standard army, if you like. They've not really battled in those formations that you'd expect. And what they've done is they've employed methods of hit and run, methods in which small groups of small units have gone in, done the operations, and then disappeared into the sand almost. And I think that's perplexed and totally bamboozled a Saudi military which was armed to the teeth with missiles and all the latest hardware. How do you fight an army which can disappear not only into the desert, underground, overground, wherever, or even into the towns and villages? You're basically fighting the people. So where are you going to find these forces to fight? Not only that, they've actually demoralized a mercenary army because the Saudis didn't want a boots on the ground situation. Because the air power failed, what they did was started to import mercenaries from Sudan, Somalia, other places. So these mercenaries that they're fighting are not dedicated to any cause or commitment, whereas the Ansarullah are fighting for their families, for their children, for their nation. There are many differences to this virtual victory, I see.
Okay, well, Brett, tell us the importance of what is happening right now, because we know about the situation in Marib and the offensive and every day having more and more victories. The importance of capturing Marib.
We have to bear in mind that Marib is the last and only major stronghold that the Saudis and their supporters still have in central and central northern Yemen. Except for Marib, their entire stronghold, their entire foothold in Yemen is almost entirely concentrated in the thinly populated, be it strategically located, south and east of Yemen, which is very sparsely populated, which is not a very it's not a very well-developed area when compared to the more populated areas that are still under control of the National Salvation Government and protected by Ansarullah and their allies. So when Marib falls, this will be a very massive blow, not just, you know, militarily, but also economically and spiritually, mentally, for the Saudis and their allies. We already know, of course, that the Saudis, when it comes to Yemen itself, they to Yemeni troops, the few Yemenis that are fighting on their side are for the majority members of the Islam Party, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan movement in branch in Yemen. And we know that within the Islam Party there is a growing rift that has started, especially in Marib, in which some groups of the Islam Party are thinking of negotiating and have already even offered certain, you know, venues of negotiations that so far unfortunately have not yet led to a capitulation of the city, but it's a start. And one of the reasons for that being is that the National Salvation Government still to this very day offers a general amnesty to every mercenary, every Yemeni who joined the Saudi forces, who decides to defect, put down the weapons or hand in their weapons and decides to return back to civilian life. And it's perfectly still, or that venue is still open. So aside from that loss of a major Islam Party stronghold, the potential loss of the last vestige of northern and central Yemeni power that the Saudis still have, there is the massive economic importance in terms of oil and gas. Not so much necessarily that the Saudis need the oil, but the oil is now at least kept out of Yemeni hands. That is their goal. Try to keep the country as poor as you can be. If that oil were to go back into Yemeni hands, and Yemen could possibly, potentially in the near future, negotiate further economical oil deals with other countries, if the government in Sana'a could somehow manage to sell that oil on the international market again, this is a massive influx of funds again that belongs to Yemen, but so far has been kept out of Yemen for almost 7 years now. So when all these things come together, and we have to bear in mind that at this point it's not only in Marib, but also the East Coast has been, the areas have been liberated at a rapid pace. Just today there was a report that the Kilo 16 area, which is the major road between Sana'a and Hodeidah, mm-hmm. has been liberated and has reopened after 3 years of Emirati blockade. The Emiratis have retreated, the Yemenis have moved back in, and the road, the direct routes between the major cities of Sana'a and the major port city of Hodeidah, both of them who are in hands of the National Salvation Government, that road is open again now. There is a direct line of transportation from the port to Sana'a. All these things taken together represent a complete and total breakdown of Saudi and Emirati stranglehold in central Yemen, which means that they will have to withdraw almost completely to the south, to Aden and to Hadramaut.
Okay. Well, Said Mohsen, let's look at the Saudi allies, I mean, such as the United States and Britain. Both countries had discussed the need to curtail sales of further military equipment to Saudi Arabia, but we've seen the opposite. The Biden administration has recently approved $500 million more. I mean, why do both these Western countries continue to show their hypocritical policies when it comes to Yemen? On the one hand, it says that the violence must cease and civilians should not be killed. On the other hand, we see that they continue to support the Saudi regime.
Well, the entire strategy and policy of, if you like, Zionist exceptionalism across the world, and of course the domination of that region and the plunder of the resources of that region, has relied fundamentally on Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been the one that has been buying a lot of the nations around that region with its dollars, persuading them, maintaining a status quo, making sure that they didn't rebel against the Zion American order in that region. So Saudi Arabia has been a linchpin, really, for Anglo-Zionist policy and imperialism in that region, keeping all of the nations to heel. The reality is that the situation is changing. The resistance axis has fundamentally changed the dynamics in this region. For the relevance of Yemen, of course, whilst it was under the Saudi yoke, Yemen was not allowed to access its nickel, gold, copper, cobalt. You know, the oil and gas fields have been mentioned, but there's been a huge amount of wealth which has been suppressed by the Saudis. They've not allowed the Yemeni rulers, who were their puppets, to unearth any of those. You've also got this entire situation, for instance, with the outcome of the current situation changing the face of West Asia, potentially. What happens in Marib is no small thing. It could literally change the face of West Asian geopolitics and geoeconomics. Firstly, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait leads straight to the Suez, so that immediately hits Israel and Egypt. If the Ansarullah were to take control of that entire strait, it would cause huge problems for the likes of Israel and Egypt in their strategies and policies. It would be a win-win for the likes of China and Islamic